Hello and welcome to Everyday Oral Surgery. This is your host, Dr. Grant Stuckey. I am an oral and maxillofacial surgeon practicing in Denver, Colorado. The goal of this podcast is to connect, learn, and inspire. In this podcast, you'll be hearing from OMS surgeons all over the globe discussing ways to improve the practice of oral and maxillofacial surgery. Most information shared in this podcast will be based on personal experience and opinions, so please supplement what you learn here with approved research studies. If you are a regular follower of the podcast, please go to our website, everydayoralsurgery.com, and register to receive newsletters and find links to our social media accounts. Most importantly, if you would like to be interviewed on the podcast or know someone who you'd like to hear from, or if there's a topic you'd like to hear about, please email me at grantstuckey@gmail.com. Without further ado, please enjoy today's episode. All right, welcome to another episode. Today I'm with Dr. Dan Hammer. He's an oral and maxillofacial surgeon practicing in Southern California. Dan, thank you so much for joining us again on the podcast.
Thank you so much for the invitation. Great to be here, Grant.
Yes, I'm excited to talk to you again. The first podcast we did, we kind of talked a little bit about your involvement in the kind of the armed forces and that aspect. Also, doing kind of big cancer type recon cases, pathology cases, being a single degree surgeon. I loved hearing about that. So really cool stuff. I in this past AMIS meeting, I saw that you talked and kind of gave a presentation on doing implants in people who have had fibula bone grafts. And so I thought it would be good to kind of discuss some of that. Could you just start us off by kind of talking to us a little bit about these patients and when you feel like they're suitable to do dental implants?
Yeah, absolutely. And first and foremost, I just want to let all listeners know that although there's a lot of perceived challenges with treating this patient population, I promise you it's one of the most rewarding experiences you could ever do. Just before I get into the details of the surgery stuff, in 1974, the Journal of Prosthodontics, there was an article, and it was called The Forgotten Patient of Maxillofacial Prosthetics. And it talked about the segmental mandible patient. And it pretty much, everybody's okay cutting jaws off. And then nowadays, everyone's super comfortable putting leg bone in the face bone. But then there's this huge chasm between the reconstructive surgery side of the house and actually getting people dentally restored. And I would argue, looking at the current literature, these patients are still the forgotten patients. We have, sure, John O'Day has, you know, become popular and everything, but it's still done in a very small number of places in the United States, like consistently. And the most recent literature I saw, even for people who had dental implants placed in the fibula at time of surgery, less than 20% of them actually got a final prosthetic.
Wow.
So 80% of patients in the United States, even after getting implants placed, are still not getting a dental prosthesis. So, you know, and there's lots of reasons given, but you know, from my experience doing a lot of, you know, tertiary and quaternary recons on these patients, it's usually because the implants and or the bone are just in non-restorable location, and you could put teeth on them, but they just would not be functional. So I really appreciate, you know, the invite to talk on this topic. I'm super passionate about it, and I think that oral and maxillofacial surgery, regardless of your training background, this is just all on four principles, right? It's just, instead of with a alveolus or, you know, basal bone, you're dealing with a fibula. So I really want to, you know, hopefully start this conversation here, and I hope people reach out. There are a lot of people who are just walking around inadequately restored and pretty much being told by people, we saved you from cancer. You were in that bad trauma. You had that congenital blank, right? At least that's gone and you have a face. So just really, really appreciate the invitation. And to kind of go back to your original question, thanks, I'll get off my pulpit now, is, you know, what do you look for, right? And I know this sounds like I'm practicing for boards, like start with your H&P, but it start with your H&P, right? But I think there's unique things for the history. And one thing that is not taught is talking about their expectations, right? Like just upfront, right? Somebody shows up twice radiated. That's their second fibula because the first fibula died.
Mm-hmm.
They can't open their mouth, you know, to speak. They're G-tube dependent, right? All these other things. Like, yeah, like you got to start with the history, understand their complete treatment, what they've gone through, and then just ask the question, what is your goal, right? Before you get into the technical part, because you might see a disconnect, either A, what their expectation is just not possible, or this is for each surgeon to figure out themselves. Maybe after you go through their whole kind of treatment history and then you hear their expectation, you as an individual practitioner might not be able to deliver that outcome. And so that's when you phone a friend or, get a collaborative team around the patient. So I think one thing that's unique about these patients amongst many others is you have to understand expectations right away because these patients are already burned out. They've already had tons of surgeries. And if you could not predictably execute dental rehabilitation, I would argue you should not even try because you're just setting them up for further, psychosocial impact or bring a teammate on. And I know a lot of people I help kind of get into this space. Their first couple cases they'll do with another surgeon. Okay. Just for like learning purposes, and especially private practitioners out there who are solo owners, like a lot will just like partner up with another solo owner and tack these together as they get more comfort with it.
I like that. Okay, so there's kind of, I like how you're talking about their expectations, figuring out, what they want, what you can achieve. So let's say we get past that and we feel like we can get them some improvement. What are some of the surgical kind of challenges or things we should be aware of with these placing implants into fibula reconstructed bone compared to just doing it in the native mandible?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the biggest thing, since a great majority of fibulas done in the United States are for oncology patients. So I think really understanding the radiation history and we have to think about it. If you're putting it into the fibula and the fibula is radiated, that fibula is likely replacing the area that was affected by the oncology. So it's most likely going to be in that primary field or very close to it. So I think really understanding the radiation, placing the dental implants in a fibula post-radiation does have a lower success rate compared to placing the implants at the time of fibula harvest. And obviously that's, you get that initial healing and primary transition to secondary stability before the radiation hits. So that's our thought on why you have better success. So you have to have that candid conversation with the patient. Another thing is, we get so worried about AP spread, right? And all this stuff, but if somebody has like an anterior fibula in the mandible and then you have less radiation in the back, you may only put one implant in the front and just see how it does with the ORN. And then you might put, some more posteriorly in the native mandible, just not to risk osteoarrhea necrosis across the entire flap. And then the other thing is talking with the reconstructive surgeon on how long has it been since the fibula was placed? Were there any complications with the surgery? The patient might not know the whole history. So I think if you were not the reconstructive surgeon doing the fibula, I think it's just important to talk to the reconstructive surgeon and say, hey, I'm thinking about placing these. This is kind of my idea. They can fill you in on what's happened in the past. And let's be honest, if a case doesn't go well, you don't want to be calling that reconstructive surgeon after the fact saying, oh, by the way, your recon bar is exposed. Oh, by the way, your fibula is fractured. oh, by the way, I cut through your skin paddle and it's dead, right? So yeah. I think that's one of the things you definitely have to consider when taking on these patients is this cannot be done on your own. These are complex patients, and you really need to engage the entire treatment team to offer a really optimized result.
Okay. Yeah, that is a really good point to kind of get in touch with the surgeon who did it, get the history, you know, find out if there's surgical techniques that you need to be doing to protect the patient and the success. With fibula grafts, you know, comparing it to the native mandible, I assume that most of them are shorter than the native alveolus and the soft tissue is thicker. Is that kind of a good assumption?
Yeah, no, it is. And because of the bony height being so much shorter than a native mandible, it really comes down to where did the reconstructive surgeon put the fibula? And there is a huge paradigm shift happening in the U.S. right now. The traditional way of doing a fibula flap is you line it up with the inferior border of the mandible. And that the kind of dogma behind that is because then you maintain the facial form from like a skeletal or aesthetic approach. But what we know is as you move inferiorly on the mandible, if you line up the buccal plate, you're always going to be too far buccal and almost be giving the patient a Brody bite in the posterior and a cross bite in the anterior, just because of the buccal positioning of the inferior border versus the alveolar bone. So that's the biggest thing you need to, you know, look at from there. We're really trying to change that paradigm. There's tons of oral surgeons in this space who are lecturing constantly. We need to move on past that. And instead of putting the fibula arbitrarily on the inferior border, we bring it up off the inferior border and we use our all on, you know, knowledge and experience. And we place the fibula based on restorative space, which, you know, top down versus, you know, bottom up, which to us makes complete sense. But I'll tell you, that is not always the case. And Dr. Williams and the team at JPS will be publishing a paper soon showing that even if you bring the fibula up off the inferior border, you still get aesthetic outcomes that are very much, you know, welcomed and accepted by patients. So you're absolutely right. That's a huge difference. And you can imagine if the bone's super buccal and super inferior and you're trying to get it into a proper occlusion, you have serious, serious lateral forces being placed on that implant. So that's why, you know, only 20% of people actually get teeth, because when it's done this non-restoratively driven manner, it's hard to get the occlusion back in. So that's part of the evaluation process, right? Is get that cone beam CT, throw it in whatever implant planning software, you know, you use. And before you even commit to anything to a patient, you need to get into a virtual world, place implants, look at your relationships, and see if there's anything you can do. Because unlike a normal alveolus, right, the bone side, you can't really graft a fibula well. Like you can't like just like put some an avascular graft on top, even with the titanium mesh, and get success. I mean, one, it's long bone. Two, we all know it's soft tissue envelopes everything. And for most people, post radiation, post freeze tissue, you don't quite have the soft tissue envelope you need. Yeah. So people have documented it, but it's not easy, especially in a radiated field.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting to hear how the shift in mindset of where we're putting the fibula and trying to position it better for dental rehabilitation. Yeah, I would think that would help a lot with practitioners feeling better and prosthodontists feeling better restoring them when you've got implants higher up that don't have a big, huge dip in the bone and the soft tissue where it's a big food trap and you got a big, long prosthesis.
Yeah, and from your comments, I can tell that you may have dealt with that before. Yep. And I think a lot of oral surgeons who are listening have, when you all of a sudden inherit this patient and you have this huge step off between the native mandible and the fibula, and there's really not a lot of recovery for that. And we all know that's usually the implant that fails first, that implant right next to the native mandible, just because you can't keep it clean. And it dies for the same reason peri-implantitis kills implants elsewhere. And the other thing you brought up was soft tissue. So we kind of just talked about the hard tissue, but the soft tissue is super, super important. And once you get the bone in the right place, and people do segmental osteotomies of fibulas to get the fibula back in the right place. Like that is actually something that's done, if you can imagine. Obviously, there's risk associated with that, which is a whole nother discussion. But most of the time, the issue with these patients is they have no vestibule.
Yeah.
And they show up to you and they have this huge, skin pillow on top of their neoalveolus that's mobile. And somehow you need to get down to this tiny piece of bone that's left and make that tissue immobile. So that's a pretty darn good challenge. And I don't know about the listeners out here. If you have any more ideas, call me or email me. But vestibuloplasty in those patients is very challenging. It's very, very challenging to get a predictable outcome, regardless if you're using the implants to retain a splint or using fixation screws through like an Aquaplast to hold a skin graft down. Or, I mean, there's so many different ways people have done this, right? But it's a really big issue. So one of the things we're teaching, in addition to putting the bone in the right place, is for dental rehabilitation, is traditionally, and this is what you would ask your reconstructive surgeon, traditionally dental implants have been taught to come out the posterior aspect of the fibula. The problem with that is then the skin paddle goes right over it, because the skin paddle comes off posteriorly. So what we're trying to teach now is that the implant should come out of the anterior. So then the skin paddle will come up and over the reconstruction plate on the buccal aspect. And then as it scars in, it actually deepens your vestibule rather than obliterates your vestibule.
Okay.
And I can tell you, I mean, obviously that's my own dogma, that I learned in Texas, but I have not had to do, in 25 jaunt a days, any revision vestibuloplasties when the anterior is up and then the implants are going in the anterior. So even if you start getting into the space and talking to the recon surgeon ahead of time, things like putting the bone in the right place, things like, hey, can we put the anterior fibula as the neoalveolus, that would really help me to recreate a vestibule, since vestibuloplasties are so unpredictable in these patients. So a lot of this planning, hopefully, as you get into this space, you can start talking to the recon surgeons ahead of time, which will make your life much easier. And more importantly, the patient will actually get a good outcome.
Yeah, that's awesome. Are you doing fibular graft and simultaneous implant placement the same day the majority of the time, or is this like usually delayed implant placement, or when are you placing your implants?
Yeah, great question. And it's definitely evolved. And there are patients that, shouldn't get a fibula with implants and teeth the same day, mostly patients with huge like mucosal defects from cancer, right? Where you're going to get a oral like cervical, fistula, something like that. But here's my new dogma. I truly believe, as long as resources and everything else is available and the systems are available to a patient, they should get the fibula and the implants, because we know that the implants do better and there's less complication if you place them right away. I also think that at the time of surgery, if the resources and team are available, you should inset the fibula with the implants, do the pickup impression, and have the prosthesis ready for delivery. Now, there's cases, about 25% of my cases, I don't deliver the tooth, because there's a reason, right? And once again, it's mostly that the soft tissue defect from the cancer or the trauma is too significant that I would compromise the overall reconstruction. So I don't do the teeth. But what I do for those patients is, just 6 weeks after surgery, I already have my implants in. I already have my multi-units on. I already have my multi-unit covers on. So I can palpate them right through the skin paddle, right? Oh. 6 weeks post-op, I just go ahead and I make little incisions with a 15 blade right through the skin paddle, uncover, and since my prosthesis is already picked up, I literally just click it into place, and then that patient is restored in a delayed manner. But still, I mean, 6 weeks post-op is pretty sweet, or like 8 weeks post-op. And let's be honest, you can do that in your clinic, right?
Right.
So there's no easier pickup impression, I promise you, than taking it on a leg compared to, you know, in the mouth and holding the vertical and, you know, do it, you know, I promise you, if you can do a good all-on pickup in the mouth, you can do it on a leg. So that, I think that's the new ideal kind of paradigm, but I do understand it. I mean, you need the right people in the OR, you need the right team, you need the coordination for post-operative care in the private sector, but that would be ideal. At a minimum, placing the implants, but when you place the implants, and then maybe that's it, just don't put a cover screw on. Good luck finding them. And then you're going to have to go searching. So if you're going to just place implants, put a multi-unit, a tall one, on just for fun, and then put a cover on that. I promise you it will save you a lot of time and heartache.
Good surgical pro tip right there.
Yeah. Ask me how I know.
Right.
Oh, right. Man.
On a wild goose chase looking for the healing cover screw down there. Gosh, not fun. Hey guys, real quick, KLS Martin is offering a 35% discount on my favorite KLS Martin instruments for everyday oral surgery listeners. So there's a link in the podcast notes with a full listing and a video highlighting some of the advantages of using KLS Martin instrumentation. To utilize this offer, use promo code STUCKYFAVES with a capital S and a capital F. So capital S, lowercase T-U-C-K-I, capital F, lowercase A-V-S. And you can use that through your KLS Martin sales rep or by emailing usa@klsmartin.com. I handpicked these instruments based on the kind of favorite extraction instruments that I use on a daily basis. And I hope you enjoy them.
Absolutely. And another thing for the surgeons out there, you know, the traditional teaching with implant placement, I mean, in general, but definitely in the fibula world, is to place the implant subcrestal.
Okay.
That was kind of the MO. And most, I'd say majority of surgeons do that still. I will tell you about 18 months ago, after actually for some of my moonlighting, I was starting to place a lot of tissue level implants with the polished collar. And my referrals were a lot happier because we never had a profile. And, you know, the soft tissue looked really, really good. And then I was like, well, we have this huge issue with granulation tissue and access to implants and fibulas when you go subcrestal. So why don't we start doing this in fibulas? And the advantage I see for placing polished collar supercrestal implants in a fibula is you get your platform, your actual platform, above the muscle cuff.
Okay.
So if you think about it right now, if you go subcrestal, not only are you dealing with, you know, your biogas at the bone, but then you're below the bone, and that bone, it's not like bone and periodontia that like we understand. It's bone muscle with some type of soft tissue over it. It could be skin, it could be mucosa, it could be KG, who knows what it is, depending on the patient. So I really believe by doing supercrestal, the bone is no longer the issue because you're above it. You're above your muscle cuff. And so really your soft tissue management, quote unquote, is just whatever your superficial peri-implant soft tissue is. And we know how to manage KG. We know how to manage mucosa, right? So that's been a paradigm shift in my practice. And then I'll tell you, my granulation tissue and my peri-implant complications, it has decreased since I've gone to a polished collar. The other thing with that is when you're placing the implants, if you're not trying to get subcrestal, fibulas aren't flat. Right? So if you're going subcrestal with a non-polished collar, then you're probably going to have to profile the heck out of one side because it's at an angle to able to get your abutments on, right? But if you're supercrestal, then you have that flexibility, and you may have to profile a little bit, but it's nothing compared to trying to go subcrestal. So that's how my practice has changed over the past 12 to 18 months. And as long as you have the restorative space, right? That's why people don't like doing them, regardless of fibular or native bone. As long as you have the restorative space, which most fibulas, you have plenty. That's something I would implore people to think about.
If you don't mind me asking, are you doing Straumann, or what kind of tissue level implant are you placing?
Yeah, so I work for the U.S. government. And so I have a mandated contract, but I'm using 3i right now because that's our contract. But I mean, they have a great product and it's working well.
Okay.
And I'm using the narrow implants, regardless of company.
Okay.
Remember, this is a little fibula, regardless of how big the person is, especially if you're doing this post radiation. Okay. I just want to get it in, get primary stability. I do not want to out fracture either of the cortices, right? Mm-hmm. I want to limit my periosteal stripping. I'm a big fan of narrow implants. And for those who have experience in this space, I've never had a spinner implant in a fibula. You will torque out way faster than any implant that you've ever placed. So I'm not worried about that.
Okay. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I was going to ask that. Because there's more cortical bone in the fibula, are there, and I assume less blood supply, can you expect less success with implants in a fibula? Or like, what is the success rate?
Yeah, great question. So they're overall quite successful. I mean, even in the post-radiated patient, you're talking 85%+ success. If you're talking about before radiation placed at the time of surgery, I mean, you're talking like mid-90s, right? So you're there. I will say, take what I said with a little bit of an asterisk, though, because in the native mandibular maxilla, we have very, very strict criteria now of what success is. But I think we need to remember what success used to be. Pretty much it was like, is the implant in the mouth? And that's what we said, right? For like normal implants, we're starting to get a group together to really kind of look at this with fibulas, but we don't have that strict criteria. So when I'm quoting 98% or 94% success or greater than 85%, take it with a grain of salt. Right now, we're still in that archaic, the dental implants in the mouth, it's osseointegrated.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of us have gotten to the point where we don't get much bone loss and it's good to go, but we don't have studies that actually have that success rate defined as anything more than good torque tests at 3 months and osseointegration.
Got it. Okay.
So be careful with the literature.
Yeah, this is fantastic. I just love how you're thinking, both surgically, but also dentally, and trying to really help these patients as much as you can to get to a good dental place after the surgery, and doing as much as you can during that initial reconstruction. Very, very awesome. I know some providers and surgeons that, once they see a fibula that's been there for a few years and there's no implants, they're, especially if they didn't do the surgery, they're kind of concerned and about placing implants and causing infection and the fibula to fail and all this stuff. And so sometimes these patients can kind of be like, the hot potato situation where they're getting passed around from provider to provider. Can you just talk a little bit about what happens, like if an implant were to fail and all that stuff?
Yeah. Yeah. No, this is a great question. Super, super important, right? And us as surgeons, I mean, all OMSs are reconstructive surgeons. And as reconstructive surgeons, you got to have plan A, plan B for when plan A fails, plan C, et cetera. So same thing here. So let's think about, two main things. Number one, you have to have a solid conversation with the restorative dentist on what the actual plan is, right? Like, are they thinking fixed? Are they thinking removable? What are the requirements of the final prosthesis before we get into what we're actually doing, right? If they're talking about doing removable on locators, well, the vestibule is pretty darn important then. right?
Yeah.
You know, trying to get a lingual vestibule, trying to get something, not saying the flange is retaining on something with locators, but we all know they do better with bite force when you can actually push down on the prosthesis, right? And we know your locator lasts a heck of a lot longer, right? Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, to your point, a lot of the reason these patients are kind of hot potatoed around is not only do you need a surgeon who's willing to take them on, but you need a restorative dentist who really has a clear vision on where they're going. So I think understanding, are we going removable? Are we going fixed? Most prosthodontists that I have met in this space are used to removable on fibulas, right? You just, somebody snuck one implant in because they didn't want to break it. And then that's all the prosthodontist had to use. And then there's like this big, huge piece of acrylic off of one implant or two, right? Like that's like very much common practice in the United States. I would argue though, the more predictable thing for the patient, because that's bound to fail, right? Eventually, is to do fixed. And with the printed nano ceramics these days, I mean, you can drive the price down on a final prosthesis pretty far, you know, for fixed. And here's the advantage of fixed in these patients. You don't have to worry about the vestibule as much, right? You don't need a lingual recess. You just need the bone in the right place with the implants coming out at the right angle, and then you can immediately load. So that's point number one, is you can eliminate a lot of failure opportunity, or maybe a better way of saying is mitigate the risk of failure in these patients if you have a clear, coherent plan with your restorative dentist that matches the expectations of your patient. Like,
yeah,
it's just like the first day of residency, right? It's like proper planning prevents piss poor performance, right? Like the surgery becomes the easy part. The planning is the difficult part for these. The second one, getting a little bit more myopic, is the biggest thing I want to do when I place implants in a delayed setting. I do not want to compromise the reconstruction plate. And I do not want to compromise the continuity of the fibula and somehow give the patient an iatrogenic fracture, right? Or like a discontinuity of the mandible. And I know I'm talking mostly about the mandible, but let's be honest, 80-90% of fibulas done in America are for the mandible. So the maxilla is a whole other beast for a different podcast. So the way I protect against that is, one, I don't place the implants unless my soft tissue is optimized, or else it's useless, right?
Okay.
So if that's you doing debulking, if that's you doing a vestibuloplasty, whatever your choice is, the soft tissue has to be under control. And what I mean by that is it actually going to come down to the bone level? And is there any way for you to make it immobile? Okay. So I think a lot of us get excited. We place the implant, but then we still have a centimeter of soft tissue above it.
Yep.
And then we're trying to figure it out. So I think we need to think about it in the reverse. Once your soft tissue is under control, I only place monocortical dental implants and fibulas. And I do shorties. So I only place either a narrow, whatever your company is, narrow, by like 8.5 or 10. You do not need bicortical, you know, engagement in order to get primary stability. These all torque out a ton. The primary stability is always going to come from the first cortex, right?
Right.
So there's no reason. And here's my other reason for it. So let's say you place the world's best implant in a fibula. Good job. But it fails, because implants fail sometime. If you're doing monocortical, and the reconstruction plate, usually the fixation screws are always coming through the inferior aspect of the fibula, you know, as far away from the incision line as possible. I have had a patient where we loaded them too quickly. It was a hemi arch, loaded too quickly. I had two implants fail, and it actually caused a green stick fracture of that superior cortex. And yes, it was a catastrophic failure, right? Like I could take out my teeth with my two implants, right? All together with a piece of bone in between. But the overall reconstruction was totally safe. The reconstruction plate looked fine. The continuity of the mandible, the fixation screws, because I only placed the implant in the first cortex.
Got it. Yep.
If the implant would have been through both cortices, I would have been trephining Right? Or mm-hmm. it would have outfractured, and now I would have just recon bar with no fibula, which we know sets up a whole bunch of issues. So for those reasons, I'm a big fan. Shorty implants, you will get primary stability, I promise. And if it's only in one cortex and all the fixation screws and the recon bar are on the inferior aspect of the fibula, independent of where you're placing your implants, then even if you get a catastrophic failure like that case I just shared with you, the patient might not get teeth there, but at least they have a fibula and a recon bar, and you're not completely redoing. You're not going to their other leg, because let's be honest, that's what you would have to do.
Yep. Okay. That makes a lot of sense to just engage that first cortex and hedge your bets and it kind of plan. If it were to fail, at least you got the continuity of the fibula and the, not having to have even more catastrophic problems by doing bicortical that now has to be removed. Yeah.
And I still, just to clarify for the audience, I still use my like 2-0 twist and everything bicortically.
Okay.
And I'll always, for my shaping drills, let's say I'm placing like a 10, I'll do a shaping drill to like an 11.5 or like 13, just yeah. So when I'm placing it, if I'm getting an increased torque value, I know it's not because I'm like bottoming out mm-hmm. on the second cortex, right? It's that I truly am just getting too much torque on that first cortex and I need to either tap or I just need to, you know, do the classic 2 turns down, 4 turns back,
yeah,
back down, let it breathe. And for everyone out there, y'all, everyone has to have patience when they're placing these, especially if you place a ton of implants and you're used to zipping through and making it happen. You do that, you will break a fibula. You gotta just take your time. I used to place my implants with a motor and just set it at 50 Newton centimeters, but it wasn't giving me the like tactile feel I needed to understand. So then I tried to back it up and it was very difficult. And I thought I was going to flower these little narrow implants. So now I place everything just with a normal like torque wrench.
Okay.
And I just do it by hand. And I'm telling you, like that tactile feel, you know, just as it's getting tight and that way you can kind of let it expand. And then when you try to reverse it, it's not like this, like I'm saying a prayer as I'm pushing it back because I don't want to strip it or flower it. So just some things that I've learned from placing lots of implants and fibulas.
Got it. And are you placing these implants? Are you freehanding them? You guided them? How are they going in?
Yeah, great question. So if I'm doing it immediately, we have it guided. And there's two companies out there that we've created a platform for. So you can fully integrate your dental implant guided system now into the fibula cutting guide and everything. Cool. Like nice. they even know, you know, the outer diameters of your keys and everything. Yo, yeah. So you can do just like you're doing a guided case in your office with the keys and everything. You can do it on a leg now.
Nice.
And we have it so integrated now. The patient can actually get the temporary prosthesis, either printed or PMFA, included in the bundle now for immediate dental rehabilitation. Covered by the healthcare administration, you know, bundle for the recon. So, this space is exploding, and the plating companies have done an amazing job to fully integrate. So if it's immediate, I mean, that's covered. In the delayed setting, that's the issue, right? So the prosthodontist I work with, Mike Anderson, who's my right hand and absolute genius, we're working with some companies now on ways. So like, you know, Grant, a patient shows up to you and you're like, I don't really want to freehand this because I want to know where the bone is. And this isn't like flat bone that I know I can just like go deeper in or go wider, right?
Yep.
To come up with, you know, kind of a planning guide that can be printed. The biggest issue is with these patients, all the guides, and I do guided, we do our own design using Blue Sky and Mesh Mixer for these cases. So I definitely do them guided if I'm trying to do like immediate load. If you're just placing implants, I mean, you can freehand it as long as you get a good cone beam and you understand where you're going. But if you're trying to do immediate load, it has to be a bone-borne guide. right?
Yeah.
And you're not going to be able to do a stackable. And you know what I'm saying? There's just limitations. And then you're also not, you don't want to expose your recon bar or your mini plates. So you can't use pins, right? And then you're dealing with a lot of soft tissue. So totally doable. We've done a bunch of them, but you just got to know you're going to have to make a big incision, right? In order to get a bone-borne guide in. And you know you're going to need multiple guides because you're going to have to take one for your, you know, alveoplasty. If you're going to do that to the native mandible, then you're going to take that one out. Then you're going to have your implant placement guide. So yeah, definitely possible. If you can design your own guides for normal ons, it's the same thing. But you have to do bone borne because the last thing you ever would want to do is expose the recon plate.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, that's good to hear that it's covered and that you can do all this immediately and guide it. And I mean, that's just fantastic. It's so awesome. What a great service to be able to give to these patients.
Yeah, it's been amazing. And all this has really come to market within the past 12 to 18 months. So it's just been incredible to see this space.
It's so cool. Well, that's great. I mean, that's most of my questions. This has been very enlightening for me, and I appreciate you walking us through your technique and how you work these patients up and treat them surgically, and their rehabilitation afterward dentally is awesome.
It's my pleasure, and I know I probably said some things that reinforced concern to some of the surgeons listening about these patients, but I promise with the skill set you have as an oral maxillofacial surgeon, you can take on these cases. You can do them very, very well. You know, I've said this to Grant before, you know, my information will be available. You know, you can reach out via email or actually it's dorky, but Instagram is the best way to get a hold of me because the only people who message me on Instagram are other surgeons or like residents. And it's where you get to my email, you're going against my bosses and other stuff. So Dr. Dan Hammer on Instagram or shoot me an email, but I will definitely help anybody who's interested in making sure that these patients are not the forgotten patients 50 years from now. And I think our specialty is poised to be the leaders in this space.
Oh, so great. Well, that's fantastic. Can you, sorry to end the fibula talk, but can you tell me if you've read any good books or watched any good movies lately that you recommend?
So I can't say the entire title of this book, but it's literally one of the best books I have listened to because I'm an audible guy during my commute. Yep. So I listen, but The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Blank it is absolutely fantastic. And it's been a centering book, and a lot of people think it's like rude, but I'm telling you, it's actually the thesis pretty much is care about what's important to you and the things that are important to you. It just has a catchy title.
Yes, I like that. That's fantastic. Okay. Do you watch Netflix or any shows at night, or you just go straight to bed once you get home?
The sad thing is, you know, between work and the military, and then, you know, like we were talking about, I have a 4 and a 5 year old daughter. I do go to bed quite early these days, but kind of maybe a vice for my wife and I is right now. Well, The Voice, it just ended. So yeah. We like watching The Voice. So
I love The Voice. Yes.
Yeah, that's the one. I fall for the cheesy stories and get inspired by it.
Yeah, I love the blind auditions at the beginning. That's my favorite part. I kind
for
of
sure.
Sometimes I lose wind when it gets further on in the competition, but I love the first
absolutely
part. Oh, that's great. All right, my man. Well, thanks for your time today. I appreciate you sharing, and I'll put this information in the show notes if anyone wants to reach out to you, or they can reach out to me and I can pass on your information. So
awesome.
Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity, and thanks for everything you're doing for oral surgery. Really inspired by what you're doing and put out what our specialty does and inspire the next generation.
Oh, it's my pleasure. All right, let's keep in touch and do another episode down the road.
Sounds good. Take care, man.
Thanks. Bye. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. For more information on these podcasts, please visit everydayoralsurgery.com. I love feedback and would be very grateful if you would reach out to me via my email, grantstuckey@gmail.com, and let me know what you thought of this episode. Or you can text me at 720-441-6059. Additionally, if you have any topics you'd like to hear about, or if you'd like to be a guest on the podcast, please, please email or text me. I found many of my interviewees through people who have been contacting me and have been listening, and I've gotten so many great ideas for more podcasts, and that's what helps keep the podcast rolling. So really appreciate you making that extra effort and helping me out with feedback and knowing what to do next on the podcast. Thank you so much.